Through the month of January, we opened up the platform for our brothers to share a theme of vision for the new year. Now, I am resuming my Bible teaching series, and I am going to introduce my vision, set the sights for where we want to go. Just to open a window to that, I want to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1, "Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart." You see, the Apostle Paul is rehearsing and going over the ministry that he received, the ministry of the good news of Jesus Christ risen from the dead. And it's not just a ministry for the world, but also for churches. In fact, that's where much of Paul's grief came in, as he had trouble with his own spiritual children. But you know, the ministry is so great that no matter how difficult the Corinthians might be and Christians might be and the world, you don't lose heart because you have this ministry by the mercy of God. Just remember that. It can be discouraging, even for the average Christian, to witness, to raise children, and to be faithful in the Lord. Don't lose heart. "But we have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. We refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word. But by the open statement of the truth, we commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God." You know what the Apostle Paul is pointing out? Many Christians and many pastors and many missionaries, many witnesses and many parents use underhanded ways to try to traffic in the word of God, to persuade people. And, you know, that's one of those darknesses of religion. Isn't it true? But Paul says, not us, but rather with open statement of the truth, we commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. Paul knew something about his audience. They have a conscience. No matter how depraved they might seem, deep down, God has encoded in everybody's heart an umpire, a judge, a conscience. And they're very quick to discern, to call the shots, as it were, especially if it hits them. And Paul knew that, you know what, we are not going to appeal to your emotional desires, to your wants, to ways in which we manipulate you, but we're going to appeal to you in that very inner court that God has placed within you. Whether you agree with us or not, whether you like what we're saying or not, your conscience is going to say, that's true. It's true to our sense of the morally right. And even if our gospel is veiled, the curtain is over it. It is veiled only to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. In other words, Paul is saying, you know, we're talking to people with a conscience, but we're also talking in an arena in which Satan is the god of this world. And his big job is to draw the curtain over the light, to eclipse the sun, as it were, the moon that'll eclipse the sun, to leave the world in its shadow, in the darkness. And therefore, you know, when you are living in this world, witnessing, if you're trying to teach in a church, if you're raising children, whatever you're doing, you know, you're going to come across a cosmic darkness. And you know that those people who live under the shadow of that darkness are perishing. Because you can just see it. That outside of the light of God, life gets ruined. People just get lost. And you know, in the end, they don't even know who they are, what their gender is, and how to keep their own body parts on their own bodies. They just get so confused. They don't know how to earn money or how to keep it in their pocket or how to spend it in a profitable way. They don't even know the life is sacred. And they give it up just to be murdered. Like, how lost people can be as it's an existence in perishing in that darkness. And it's in that arena that now we have to speak. Verse 5, "For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ is Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake." Again, I just want to make a point here. You know, one of the biggest sins of churches, and a lot of Christians follow it, is we testify to ourselves and to our church. Our church is great. We got a great pastor. We got great music. You got to come to church. And what we put out there is ourselves. And then we think that maybe if they come to us, to our group, they'll discover Jesus. The Apostle Paul never did that. He never preached himself. I'm just your servant for Jesus' sake. And he preached Christ. And now here's the power secret in verse 6. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Now that's the verse I would like to open up and begin to open up this morning, and from that, begin to open up our theme, the theme we will pursue. The first thing I want you to notice, standing as a witness in this arena of spiritual cosmic darkness, where Satan, the god of this world, has covered the world in a darkness and shut out the light of God. Paul goes back right to the beginning. The first word that God spoke in the Bible is, "Let there be light." Turn the lights on. And now God has to do that again. But this time it's not a physical darkness over a physical chaos and deep, but rather it's a spiritual inner darkness of the heart. Paul knows something, that when he speaks the gospel truly to the conscience of people, setting them before God, even in the arena of this cosmic darkness, he knows a beam of light from God is commanded to shine in the hearts. It creates reactions. It can attract. It can open up and make people inquire. It can make people react and run for the darkness. But believe you me, whenever the gospel is spoken faithfully, with integrity, with its true aim, it always penetrates to the heart. Now, we as Christians often don't realize that, but yet you feel it. Because you can talk about any subject you want, and people deal with it at a kind of a social, superficial level. Oh, that's crazy. You know, but boy, I tell you, you walk into a room, first of all, let's say of unbelievers, where darkness reigns, and talk about the glory of God shining in the face of Jesus, I want to tell you the reactions are deep. We know that. In fact, they're so deep, we get downright scared that we don't want to face that deep reaction. Like, you know, when it comes to the knowledge of God, nobody's neutral. The people who are godless and wouldn't give a word of praise to God, when they cuss and swear, God, the name comes out with a passion. When people want to curse, and when things go wrong, and anger against God just wells up within them. When people are religious and they get so fascinated with this subject of God. Others, like believers, are so attracted. It's music to our ears. In fact, it's music in our hearts. Here is a beam of light. And one thing I want to encourage you, the light shines. And there's one thing about light, is light is silent. You don't have to be noisy. You know, when you have a noisy light source, you want to change it, because give me the light, not the buzz, right? And we as Christians just have to realize that, yeah, something's happening here. The first word. Now he says there's two things about this light. It almost like has two poles to it. There's the glory of God. You might say, okay, what is that glory? Well, the Bible makes it very clear. The first glory of God revealed, and the only glory of God that is revealed over the whole world, is the glory of God the Creator. And I think this is really significant, and we're going to open that one up, because I want to go back to our theme of creation and living on created foundations. You can go anywhere in the world. When you talk about the Bible, they say, "What's that? It's a book. There's a lot of books in the world." When you talk about Jesus, they say, "Who's Jesus? There's a lot of prophets, there's a lot of holy men, there's a lot of gurus and sages and guides in the world," right? When you talk about church, they say, "Hey, there's a lot of synagogues, a lot of mosques, a lot of temples in the world." But when you talk about God the Creator, wherever you go, people will intuitively know what you're talking about. And that's why, you know, when the gospel spreads throughout the world, it can go into any culture, any people, no matter how far removed they are from God. When they talk about God the Creator, everybody intuitively connects with the message. It's something that we sometimes forget because our world has had to really try to shut that light off by arguing that the idea of God is nonsense. You know, I don't believe in God, blah, 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 blah. But you know, even all of their atheism and negativity on God only shows something, that they know what you're talking about. They put a lot of mental energy and a lot of noise into saying that they don't know. The fact is, you get through. This is a subject. And the Bible speaks of it. It's a knowledge that pervades the universe of humanity. And that's the glory that Paul is really referring to. And we'll see that that is indeed the case. But you see, if you get a beam of light in darkness, you really only appreciate the light if it reflects off something. And we see light in its wonder as it reflects. And then we see the full range of colors, and all of a sudden the light becomes a living space, as it were, create a living space for us. And Paul is saying, really, you know, that glory of God as the Creator comes to us in the face of Jesus. That's where now this light of the Creator takes on personality. It comes through in full, personal, face-to-face revelation. And so what Paul is doing here is he's connecting the glory of God, the Creator, which Satan wants to eclipse, with that glory now shining in the face of Jesus within our world, and making a face-to-face, person-to-person connection with people. And isn't that, in many ways, the core secret of our Christian faith? In Jesus, we have a personal relationship. You know, not an abstract relationship with God, the glory of the Creator, that idea beyond the sky. And we on earth have to try to reflect it and make whatever we can, and we get it all wrong. But once your eyes are open to Jesus, you see God in person, coming right into your life, face to face, in a personal relationship with God. And it's that that is the great wonder of now the light of God, the first light of the new creation shining in the heart. Now you say, hey, it sounds good. What's the point? Well, I'm going to pick up our theme again that I pursued last year. And that is, you know, the mark of our civilization, of our culture, is no longer that we have left Christianity. That was settled in what we would call the modern age. We call this the postmodern age. Beyond that, beyond arguing against Christianity and arguing for a replacement in secular humanism, where are we now? We're departing from the foundations of creation for life. We are so disoriented that right now we are downright apostatizing from creation itself, radically, thoroughly. And this is where, of course, the challenge comes to churches and Christians, because in the body we live in this world, and the world now demands that you don't define gender by creation. You don't define humanity, the mind, the soul, the problems, by the way God created it. In the world, everything has to be removed from being the creation of God. And the world demands that you come along with the world in departing from the created foundations. Even in relationships like marriage and family, even in economy, don't you talk about the created economy. It's all about our money economy and so on. And a darkness and a perishing is happening as we're looking at the world. Okay, you gave up the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And in that, you're giving up the glory of God, the Creator, and the very foundations of life. And what a darkness and what a perishing world are we living in, right? Now, this is where we as Christians need to position ourselves. I'm human, and therefore I can talk to you. Because, you know, a basic level, I think we share the same flesh. And if we're believers, we share the same Holy Spirit. and we share the same struggle. In my flesh, I'm going to admit, insofar as I want to stand by creation and the truth, the world makes me mad. And my tendency in the flesh would be to show a mad face. Argumentative, feisty, attacking, condemning, and so on, right? That is if you're a conservative Christian that you really still want to hold on to what the world is dismantling and destroying. But then we all know that a certain guilt comes into our conscience because Jesus came to seek and to save the lost. And how kind Jesus was to perishing sinners. How hard he was on Pharisees. And then we begin to feel ourselves now, on whose team am I? The Pharisees? They crucified Christ. Or Jesus? And yet we're confused because we feel that if we're going to be compassionate and nice, the world's going to say, okay, we'll only count you as compassionate and nice if you agree with us coming to the darkness, the fellowship of the darkness. And don't we get all confused? As we're going to take up these subjects about the created foundations of life, and on everyone we're going to see how the world is destroying, dismantling the very created foundations of life, and wants to even impose that on the church and impose that on the Christians. Yes, we have to hold our ground, as it were, defend our turf, the very created turf that we're standing on. We have to stand and defend it, to hold it these days, right? And yet, we have this ministry now just to shine as a light in the darkness. What mercy we need so we don't lose heart. How we have to orient ourselves, always remember, hey, remember these people still have a conscience. And you have to commend yourself to their inner moral sense. Remember that they themselves are in a darkness that is cosmic. They themselves are prisoners. And in that darkness, a beam of light has to shine. Not so much just in their mind, but in their heart. It's got to go deep. In that region where God alone can shine and God alone can speak. And God just wants you, as it were, to be the flashlight in which that bulb is, to release the beam and then leave it with God to shine and command in the heart. Because the Apostle Paul was very clear that a person only becomes a Christian by the call of God. He always says that you're called. God has called you through the gospel. And you become a real, genuine Christian when your faith in Jesus is not your personal decision from the start. You discover it's not your decision. Everything about you and your nature and your world would say no. You've never even dreamt of this. And when you're first of all confronted, you're saying, you know what? It's not my decision. And now God says, I'm going to speak right into your heart. It's my decision. And I'm calling you to bow in your will to my will for you. And you know, when we finally surrender, we get turned around. Yes, our will is engaged, but the initiating will is always the will of God, not ours. We always respond. So you say, okay, that's your introduction. Where are you going to take us with this? Well, we're going to go to Acts chapter 17. And I'm going to probably have to spend 2 Sundays on this, because what I want to do is show how Paul goes into his world of pagan darkness. And this is a world that really drifted away from the glory of God the Creator. And we're going to see how the Apostle Paul had to interact with it and how he had to begin by talking to them about the glory of God. What is it that really shows us what it means for God to be God? And how does it expose what we're doing in our religion and, you know, everything that we're doing? And then the Apostle Paul has to show that in a personal way of person-to-person contact with people in this world, that light and glory of God the Creator only comes to you in the face of one man. And where does that light radiate from to all the world? His resurrection. Something that really was the bomb that the Greek mind could not understand and thought was really, really ridiculous. And I still think that we as Christians struggle with really focusing our whole faith and message on the resurrection of Jesus. So let's go to Acts 17. I'm going to read the passage because it's always good for us just to read scripture. Get ourselves familiar with this, and then we'll start unpacking it. Acts 17, verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who had happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities, because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you're very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you: the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by hand. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, even as some of your own poets have said, 'We are indeed his offspring.' Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, to change their mind, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. Now when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, but others said, 'We will hear you again about this.' So Paul went out from their midst. But some men joined him and believed, among whom also were Dionysus the Areopagite, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them." Now, one thing that Luke does in the book of Acts, he gives us sample sermons. And in Paul's case, he gives the one sample sermon that he would preach in a synagogue, and that is in Acts 13. Because Paul, wherever he went, he would go to where already the knowledge of God was as placed in the Old Testament, and he'd go to the Jews first, and he'd give them the gospel. And after that, Luke has given us the sample, and you know that every time Paul talked to Jews, this was his message, this was his line. You know, evangelists have a message. They'll vary it, but they basically have their message, their line. Then you see, when it came to now a Gentile audience that didn't have the Bible, didn't have that background, Luke sets it not in the synagogue, but here in Athens, at a hill dedicated to Mars, because Areopagus simply means Mars Hill. And here now Paul has to stand on the Mars Hill, and he is set up to give the gospel. Now, we as Christians still move within these two spheres. You know, there is the gospel as we give it in church, in Sunday school. And this is the gospel given to people who are biblically literate. And just like the Apostle Paul, if you go back to his message in the synagogue, he tells the story of the God of glory calling Abraham, all the way through David, making promises to John the Baptist, to Jesus, to the crucifixion, to the resurrection. It's a story that the biblically literate people know. You know, we teach it our children. And I think it's really important in church that we continue in that tradition of tell the story and apply it to people. But then, you know what? We as Christians now are moving into a world where they don't have the story. Biblical literacy is zero. And by the way, since I am a senior, I can testify to you that was not always that way. Do you realize that when I was young, at least 90% of the Canadian population still was processed through church? Whether it was through Sunday school, daily vacation Bible schools, Christian camps, evangelistic services. In fact, when I went through school from grade 1 to grade 12, every morning we had to read the Bible, have the Bible read, and say the Lord's Prayer. And the Bible reading was put on a schedule so that you would read from Genesis through to Revelation. We still, in that sense, were saturated in the biblical story. And the only religion the people knew, even atheists and the godless, was Christianity. Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam was all strange and foreign to them. So people still thought of religion in terms of the story that we tell in a concentrated way in church. And then it happened. I graduated from high school in 1977. I'm out. My brother, who's 1 year younger than me, is now in grade 12. And the first piece of news in Abbotsford, which is the buckle of the Bible Belt, is grade 12 students walked out when, in the morning, the Bible was opened and it was to be read. You had a student walkout. It was a crisis in the Bible Belt. And the school board very quickly made some decisions. Cancel it. And what has happened since that day is the story has been forgotten. A generation grew up, and today it is really true that people's ideas of God are more Hindu than Christian, more Buddhist, whatever fragments they have of different religions. And it's the Christian story that is so foreign and so odd. So that today, we as Christians now, when we want to testify to the world, the world ain't coming to the synagogue or to church. We are standing on Mars Hill. And you could actually take the metaphor further. In Greek mythology, Mars was the god of war. How would you like to testify to the one true God against all other gods on the hill of the god of war? Isn't that how you sometimes feel? But Paul said, remember, having this ministry, by the mercy of God, we don't lose heart. Now, I think it's going further. Because it's not just that the world has completely divorced itself from Christianity. And out there, it's not only leaving Christianity, but it has brought in a very anti, not just Christian, but even anti-creational foundation of life. And now what we're finding is the pressure of that is coming into churches. And you'd be surprised that in a lot of churches, you'd find yourself on thin ice if you raised the foundational issues of life on the basis of creation. Oh yeah, you can talk about Jesus, but don't you talk about creation defining gender, sexual relationships, ethics. You know, it's interesting how quickly Christians implode. As soon as a thing becomes legal, most Christians naturally shift their moral frame or their moral thinking. And so, you know, when the world sidelined marriage, common law relationships are legal and perhaps culturally preferred, Christians very naturally accept them. than when the world establishes feminism. Contrary to everything the Bible says about gender relationships, Christians very naturally adapt because it's legal now. Then when gender orientation issues come up and different things, Christians very naturally try to adjust. Then they come with maid, and Christians have always felt that this is murder. And I had a church leader tell me 2 weeks ago that even with a person who was in their church, he all of a sudden thought that maid was a good idea. Because it's not murder, because it's something that is supported and carried out by a loving community. Don't fool yourself how whatever is out there puts a tremendous pressure. You get besieged, and it leaks in, and I could just probably not entertain you, but de-entertain you with a lot of stories of how these anti-creational ideas are seeping into even conservative churches. The dikes are leaking. Now you see, it's at this point that we as Christians all of a sudden are called to decision. Now what I would like to do is go to Acts 17, because here we have the Apostle Paul put up to it to explain the gospel. What are you talking about? And I believe that this incident, selected by Luke the evangelist under the inspiration of the Spirit, is exactly the model that we need today. There's going to be several things that we're going to notice from here. One is Paul's attitude. Believe me, attitude is important because that's the first thing that you are judged for. You know, I might approach you with a message that you will disagree with intellectually. If my body language is bad and I'm angry and I'm demeaning and I'm feisty, that's it. Your conscience will rule against me. On the other hand, if you see me being gentle, kind, respectful, honoring you, I've already won 50% of the argument because I've won your conscience. And then in most cases of human beings that are not totally depraved, you will at least give me a respectful hearing. Whether at the end you agree or not, because at the end we noticed some mocked. Others said, hey, we got to hear more about this. You know, got to think about it. Let's keep on talking about it. And others believed. The responses will not be the same, but you'll notice until the Apostle Paul dropped the bomb of the resurrection of Jesus, the resurrection of a human being from the dead, as the very means of salvation for mankind, the Athenians all followed and listened very respectfully. Okay? And so Paul was a winner here. But before he won their minds to listen and he took them for as long as he could that they would listen respectfully, Paul had to position himself. Paul walks into Athens. Athens is the cradle of Western civilization, which has dominated the whole world. So in many ways, we're here at the birthplace of our culture. And what does he see? First of all, a city full of idols. Now, you see, you can look at idols from two points of view. You can look at them from a religious point of view. And for Paul, that provoked him. The Jew came out in him. Idols, God thundering from Mount Sinai. You shall have no other gods. You shall not make an idol. God is a jealous God. Paul was provoked. That's the first thing it says, right? He was waiting here, but he couldn't shut up because he was provoked. The other side is, most of us like Athens with its artwork, its statues, not because of the idolatry. They were very good artists. This was a city that was decorated with the best of art, and it still dazzles the world. I want to tell you, the Greeks really figured out how to do sculpture and art. And then, you know, it was a city famous for its philosophies. And at that time, there were two dominant schools of philosophy, the Stoics and the Epicureans. And believe me, that's where Athenian and Greek philosophy ended, and that is exactly where we are today. And that is that philosophy, because the philosophers argued themselves out and everybody canceled each other out intellectually, because it kind of leaves you exhausted. At first, you know, you get really intrigued with philosophy until your brain gets fatigued because you just can't get two philosophers agreeing. And it all came down to virtually psychology. And there were basically two types. Epicureans were materialists, and they believed that we were just made of atoms. We don't have a soul. And the atoms came together at birth, and they fall apart at death, and we are no more. So the only thing that we really have left is to cultivate our feelings. And they wanted to cultivate pleasant feelings of happiness. So they disengaged with the world and all of its stress. And their cult, as it were, was not in temples, but in gardens, friendship gardens. And they were friendship clubs. Everything around you was just there to delight your senses. And you only wanted pleasant company to discuss pleasant themes. Honestly, I could be an Epicurean, because sometimes the world stresses me out. I say, give me a nice garden with just people of like minds, and we can have good, delightful friendship and talk and fellowship. Would you like that sometimes? That's the Epicurean, but that's all. And then they thought, you know what? When we die, it's all just atoms. We are no more. So just live to babysit your happiness. And so we get the word Epicurean from them, and that is a person who lives to be happy, a hedonist. Stoics, on the other hand, they were serious, and they didn't just think of themselves, they thought of the whole world. And they wanted to fix the world and do the best. They were the kind of socially active type of people. They couldn't sit in gardens and just be trivial in babysitting their happiness. But they were kind of pessimistic. They realized that if you engage with the world, it's going to burn you out. It's going to stress you out. And so they gave us the word apathy. That for them, the supreme virtue was not happiness, but apathy. You know what? Don't let the world ruffle your feathers. Just keep your head above it. Do your business. But then you just cultivate, you know what? It's like out in the world, doing the world's business. I'm so much under stress and I get all stressed out. And so, you know, my philosophy is to just become apathetic and numb myself and just like not get emotionally involved. And so there were high rates of suicide among Stoics, by the way. But I'm going to pause here. Do you realize that that's exactly where our civilization is at? All the intellectual activity slumps into a psychology where we babysit our emotions one way or another. In fact, you know, we have really fortified this with drugs to medicate emotions, to numb out. You know, that's why we love the yoga thing. You know, after we mess life up in our soul and we get so stressed, ultimately the religious discipline is almost like blink out for a while. So Paul is facing this center of religious art, of philosophy, but then he also faces the chattering classes. Because Luke says Athens became a magnet for wonder seekers, people who wanted to hear theories, because this is still the kind of the pool, we might say the swamp, where ideas flowed into. And people came there and they were just like curious, trying to hear something new or say something new. And it's a trivial pursuit that these people are just hungry for more news. You know, as soon as they hear something, they're finished with it. And they have to get on to another tidbit of something new. We've really slumped into this aspect of Athens. And that is the person who's addicted to the internet. And they just have to scroll. Ecclesiastes says, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, the ear with hearing. And there's a sense in which every bit of news you drink is salt water that only leaves you more thirsty. And people can spend hours and hours just scrolling through what's new and telling something different. Nothing ever really sinks in. It's not real seriousness. Okay, what are you going to do about it? Let's talk it over seriously. No. And you know, when Paul here is in this culture, this is what he's facing. By the way, there's something that Luke doesn't even mention, which Paul mentions in his letters, when he had to talk about how these Greeks converting to Christ have to change their way of life. Paul says, in their ignorance of God, they were given over to every kind of greediness, both sexual and material. Believe me, if you think of our sexual dysfunction, it was all there. It was all part of the culture. Now you got to think that Paul, he is really only a tourist here because he's not coming to preach, but he finds himself in this city and he is provoked to talk. What's going wrong here? Paul had to speak. And I think that we as Christians find ourselves in this situation within our culture. At this point, I'm just going to point one thing out. There's so much going on in Athens, and our civilization is so full of stuff, all of which can engage us, provoke us, intrigue us. How do you witness? And you could basically talk about anything here. And Paul had to become very focused. And through the din, he had to hear one thing. Through all the clutter, the claustrophobia, he was keeping his eye on the one thing that mattered. Do these people still have awareness of the human connection with God? And so, you know, he looks at the art, the architecture, idols, altars, temples. No, that blocks. That's part of that veil that blocks people's minds out from God, right? You know, he looks at the philosophies, the mind. Quite frankly, God was not on the minds of Epicureans. In fact, the Epicureans did have to believe in the gods because if not, they would have maybe got their throat sliced. But they believed that the gods were simply Epicureans who didn't care about people. And they lived in Hollywood on Mount Olympus and just babysat their own pleasures. And then they imaged that. That's what the Epicureans thought. The Stoics believed that God was a fire that was burning. It was impersonal energy and force that generated the universe. Spit out our souls, we become apathetic, and in the end, we all go back into the fire and burn up. Sort of a Buddhistic, Hinduistic pantheism. And you know, Paul is saying, I don't think that these philosophies, or these schools of philosophy, are any places that give me an opening to talk about God. So, Christian apologist, don't go for the charge and try to run through the Stoa where the philosophers we're discussing. When Paul heard the chattering classes, you know what? They're not serious. Like, do you want to waste your words on just entering this endless chatter and talk that's totally insincere, always wanting to hear a new thing, and as soon as you heard it, you go and look for something new again? When you've got something that you want people to engage with. Of course, there's all the sexual stench. It's almost like rising from a sewer. Are you going to start talking against homosexuality, which was actually very common and systemic in Greek culture? We know that even from other letters that Paul wrote. And one thing Paul showed is he basically went through town and he inspected it for one crack, for one opening where he could say, here, I can speak to you. And you know what he found? To his delight, there was an altar. And there was no idol because they didn't know who this God was. And it was called to the unknown God, the God we don't know. So we can't draw a picture of him. We can't make an idol of him. And there is some historical background to it that apparently the one report is that a plague hit Athens and all the diviners and soothsayers couldn't figure out which God to appease. So they said, well, we don't know. Just whoever this God is that we don't know, set up an altar for him. Here is the only confession of truth that Paul could connect with. Not where people know what they're doing in their art, in their discussion, in their chattering. Where behind it all, in the din, all that noise, there's just one sigh. Deep down, We really don't know. And Paul said, that is the opening. That is the one crack, as it were, in the wall through which the light shines. This is real wisdom. What are you looking for? You want to engage people with God. People present loud their art, their architecture, their philosophical discussions, the endless discussions on the internet, in the news. I mean, we're so overloaded with all of this stuff in our culture that we would make Athens look bare. You know what? It's all part of the great eclipse. It blocks even the minds of Christians from God. The clutter. You know, you'll only ever get through where you hear a whimper, a whisper, where people finally admit, for all the talk, for all the show, for all the discussion, we really don't know. That was Jesus' strategy. Remember the woman at the well? Jesus sat there and he talked to her about water, and she thought that she knew water. She wasn't controlled. She had the water part. Jesus didn't. And Jesus began to work her. Jesus confused her. At the end, Jesus brought her around and says, I really do have a problem that I can't solve. Where do you worship God? I don't know. And Jesus didn't move in on her sin. Jesus moved in where he sympathized with her. For it all, deep down, we're uncertain. We don't know. Now, I can tell you something. When you go out in the world, you know, after the talking is over, after all the entertainment, all the show, all the pomp and circumstance, after you've taken your course, if you go to university in philosophy, and they've talked about all the philosophers, I've done it. The simplest question, is there right and wrong? After all the discussion, the professor will say, we don't know. Who are you? Do you have a mind? Do you have a soul? We don't know. That's really true. And I have found that if you want to have a ray of light shining in your through your witness to penetrate people's hearts, it's only going to be where there's a crack, a rip in the curtain. Everything that people are confident about blocks out the light. Speak to them where you can sympathize with them. We really don't know. And then Paul moves in there and says, this is where I'm going to tell you who God is. It's a beautiful opening and a revelation. But Paul still has to do some spade work, some preliminary work. He's got to appeal to their conscience. He's got to now talk to them as moral beings. And he's got to pass that silent tribunal. Whenever somebody's speaking and witnessing, the audience is first of all morally judging them. You can't help but being judged because everybody's wired with a judge within. Everybody's engaged in a court case in their heart and conscience. And if you want to now take that one crack and you want to get a beam of light through that ignorance and hit the target like in laser tag, you're going to hit the guy. Believe you me, the first thing you better hit is their conscience, the way they are sizing you up ethically and morally. And I believe that is where Christians and churches fail the most. So next Sunday, we will take that one up, okay? Now we're going to go to the communion. Again, I think, you know, when Jesus brings us to the communion, he brings us to that one point where God confronts the world in a darkness, in complete mystification. When Jesus was hanging on the cross, at midday, it became dark. He himself cried, my God, why have you forsaken me? It was a genuine human cry taken from one of the Psalms of David. But it certainly was a cry that echoed in the hearts of everybody. Why? Those who knew why, because he's a criminal, because he's blaspheming, that was their answer, the ones who crucified him. But there was a centurion who heard it all. And I guess he didn't come with a prefabricated answer. And when he saw it all, he said, surely this was a righteous man. This is the Son of God just in the way he died. And you know, through that mystifying darkness over where we think we see and presenting us ultimately with the cross, which none of us, no human being would have ever thought that this was the way of God to save us, God crucified. It is there that we have come to know ourselves and laid down our lives and let the light of God shine through in his resurrection. But you know, Jesus always brings us back to this deep, mysterious moment that we connect with him at the cross and the great sacrifice that he made. And there's an attitude. You know, in the cross, Peter said he didn't return abuse for abuse, anger for anger. Jesus was actually very loving and kind. He even prayed for their forgiveness. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. The forgiveness is only for ignorance. By the way, you know, maybe I'm going to have to preach a sermon on that. God will only ever forgive a sin that is committed in ignorance. And Jesus said, you've committed the crime of the universe, crucified the Son of God, and you don't know what you're doing. And that's why I can pray for you. Oh my, even in our rage and everything, how ignorant we really are, right? And I think we all, from time to time, rediscovered, I do. Lord, you know what? I thought I was so right. But now that I get to know you more, I discover how ignorant I was. Don't we continue to repent? And don't we then always have to go back to the sacrifice of Christ to once again get that cleansing and that renewal, to rise and to be strengthened to continue the journey with this God who has commanded his light to shine in our hearts in the face of Jesus Christ. And so God bless this communion to us.